The title of the sermon today is Cassandra's Curse. Cassandra's Curse. In Greek mythology, Cassandra, a beautiful princess of Troy, was cursed to utter prophecies that were true, but that no one believed. Now, a common version of her story in mythology has Apollo trying to seduce her. To gain her favor, he gave her the power of prophecy, for she had promised to love him in return for that gift. But after receiving the gift, she went back on her word and refused him. He then cursed her so that nobody would ever believe her prophecies, even though they were true. Now, in modern usage, her name is employed as a rhetorical device to indicate someone whose accurate prophecies are not believed by those around them. Let me repeat that. In modern usage, her name is employed as a rhetorical device to indicate someone whose accurate prophecies are not believed by those around them. You know, in the campfire, which destroyed Paradise, California recently, some residents were warned multiple times to evacuate, yet they refused to heed the warning and died a horrible death in the inferno. In Richard Clark's book entitled Warnings, Finding Cassandras to Stop Catastrophes, he says horrible things have happened when accurate warnings of disasters go unheeded. People die because we fail to distinguish the prophet from the charlatan. One reason people ignore warnings is the normalcy bias. It's the phenomenon of disbelieving one situation when faced with grave and imminent danger and or a catastrophe. It causes people to underestimate both the possibility of a disaster occurring and its possible effects. This often results in situations where people fail to adequately prepare for a disaster. And on a larger scale, the failure of governments to include the populace in its disaster preparations. The normalcy bias has always been present, and it continues to be widespread in this last time. The normalcy bias is a reason people ignore serious health warnings until it's too late. You probably know some people who have done that. At the governmental level, despite dire warnings, debt continues to be created at a staggering rate. Dozens of highly educated people are giving a Cassandra-type warning, yet their warnings continue to be ignored as our politicians kick the debt can down the road. Today, there are many who see impending dangers, dangerous situations on the world scene, but are ignored, or worse. Some become the target of ridicule and are called fearmongers or doomsday preppers. Ignoring Cassandra-type warnings is a mindset throughout our present society, and unfortunately, among too many in God's church too. A good example of the Cassandra curse is told in Richard Clark's book. It involves a disaster which could have been prevented if the warning given had been heeded. The story involves a Cassandra-like person named Dr. Yukinobu Okamura. Dr. Okamura is a prominent seismologist in Japan. Japan's Nuclear and Industrial Safety Agency, the NISA, was holding meetings to discuss the safety needs of each of the country's 17 nuclear power plants. The nuclear reactor campus at the Fukushima province lay outside of the small provincial capital city by the same name, a seaside city of 300,000 people about 125 miles north of Tokyo on Japan's east coast. The six-reactor nuclear power plant complex at Fukushima was owned and operated by Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO. For TEPCO, safety at Fukushima meant focusing on earthquakes. Earthquakes are a very real and significant risk to nuclear power plants, warranting special measures. Dr. Okamura voiced his concerns since tsunamis were not on the agenda. The Fukushima reactors were close to the sea. Dr. Okamura is a short man with a quiet voice. But in June of 2009, this quiet little man had something big to say. Dr. Okamura presented evidence that an earthquake in AD 869 had created a very great tsunami in that very area, and that the seawall being proposed would not withstand such a tsunami. Okamura was asking the authorities, why are you ignoring incontrovertible data? The data, more than any other factor, drove Dr. Okamura's concerns and his warnings. On that day, however, both the government and TEPCO insisted that earthquakes were the threat, the only threat, upon which to focus. Because discussing Fukushima that day was to focus on the earthquake threat alone, tsunamis had no place in the conversation. No one even suggested an alternate time to address the threat of tsunamis. And besides, TEPCO executives noted dismissively that the 869 earthquake was simply historical. Why attempt to extrapolate information from a story from so long ago, a story not backed by today's sophisticated measurements and data? Okamura was disappointed to see that the safety report for Fukushima was approved and that the 869 earthquake had been downplayed as not very destructive. When they allowed him to the microphone, again he pressed the issue, but again his concerns were dismissed. Dr. Okamura pleaded to the panel, genuinely puzzled as to the lack of investigation. However, TEPCO decided to ignore this Cassandra-like warning and decided that the historical earthquake and tsunami of 869 would not be the model for the updated Fukushima safety guidelines. Though Dr. Okamura's warnings were ignored at those fateful meetings, this Cassandra used the geologic past to see into the future, and he had on his side the science to which he had devoted his career. Okamura's critics took a contemporary perspective and poo-pooed this account of the 869 earthquake and tsunami to be only a story. A story that feels, because it happened so long ago, like a legend. So many today take that same view of the accounts and prophecies in the Bible. They poo-poo accounts and warnings of long ago as simply myths or legends, not to be taken seriously in this modern scientific age. The Fukushima case is one of willful ignorance on the part of the regulators. It reminds me of 2 Peter 3, verses 5 and 6. Over in 2 Peter 3, verses 5 and 6, talks about willful ignorance. For this they willfully forget that by the word of God the heavens of old were, and the earth standing out of water and in the water, by which the world that then existed perished, being flooded with water. Interesting. One thing was clear to Dr. Okamura. The likelihood was very high that an earthquake and tsunami, similarly large to the 869 earthquake, would soon strike. In fact, in his calculations, it was already overdue. Sadly, it came as a surprise to most Japanese. At 2:46 p.m. on March the 11th, 2011, a magnitude 9.0 earthquake shook Japan. What would later be known as the Great East Japan Earthquake, or the Tohoku Earthquake, struck 80 miles east of Sendai on Honshu, Japan, about 18 miles below the surface of the water. The quake caused 3 to 5 minutes of vigorous shaking, and it released a series of tsunami waves from the depths of the Pacific Ocean. These tsunamis, which raced at 435 miles per hour, exploded onto the Japanese shore with a force not experienced for at least 1,000 years. The walls of water and accumulated debris roared through the coastal towns, the schools, shopping malls, resorts, and stadiums, making their way 6 miles inland, inundating hundreds of square miles of coastal region. Residents of Sendai had only 8 to 10 minutes warning before the tsunami hit. Tragically and ironically, more than 100 evacuation sites to which many citizens fled seeking safety were enveloped by the waves. Many people at tsunami evacuation sites were crushed on impact or washed away. The death toll by drowning was staggering. This was the globe's 4th strongest earthquake since modern civilization began recording measurements, and the most powerful to hit Japan in recorded history. Now let this figure sink in. More than 19,000 people were killed. 19,000 people. But it was no great surprise to Dr. Okamura, who was in a city a little over 100 miles from Fukushima when the earthquake hit. The man who had urged further consideration of tsunami risk, who could not understand why so many had ignored his warnings, was powerless to stop the terror he had foreseen. As the earthquake hit, he became horrified that he had failed to convince anyone to listen to his warning. Why? Because he knew what would happen next. The earthquake had created a giant tsunami. It moved west toward the Japanese shore, toward Fukushima. When it hit the beach, it continued inland and over the nuclear power plant's 15-foot concrete seawall in places, causing the wall to explode like a plane of glass struck by a truck. One wave, estimated at nearly 50 feet high and traveling faster than a landing jetliner, flooded the power plant an hour after the earthquake hit. 8 minutes later, more waves arrived, inundating the site. The millions of tons of seawater injected by the tsunami engulfed the plant's low-lying buildings. Conditions continued to worsen. Hydrogen leaking from the core of Reactor 1 mixed with oxygen, causing an explosion at 3:36 p.m. that Saturday afternoon. On Monday, a second explosion blew up the Reactor 3 building. The anxiety already gripping TEPCO executives, the Tokyo government, and many in the general Japanese population grew to general panic. The Tokyo government mandated a 12-mile evacuation zone surrounding Fukushima. The United States recommended that its citizens retreat even farther, to at least 50 miles away. Over the weeks that followed, radioactive water was found to be leaking into the sea. As of March 2016, about 161,000 tsunami refugees had yet to return to their homes, and many will never be able to do so. The full decommissioning effort at the plant itself is expected to take up to, listen to this, 4 decades, 40 years. Perhaps most galling about this horrendous disaster is how small and relatively inexpensive the preventive measures to heed Dr. Okamura's Cassandra-type warning could have been. Precise studies are not available, but it likely would have cost TEPCO about $50 million to create an effective combination of better backup generators, waterproofing, and higher seawalls. Listen to this. The nuclear disaster alone will cost Japan at least $100 billion, which is 2,000 times more expensive than the preventative measures. In other words, for a one-time expense of just 0.05% of the damage costs, TEPCO might have completely avoided the reactor disaster and saved thousands of lives. Amid the aftermath of the Great East Japan earthquake and the meltdown at Fukushima, it came to light that not only were Dr. Okamura's warnings ignored, a startling number of other warnings from other Cassandras, dating back even decades, were also tossed aside. Now, this sad story is just one of the many such stories chronicled in Richard Clark's book. There were Cassandra-type warnings ahead of Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, the disaster of Hurricane Katrina due to the decades-old levees, flood walls, canals, and pumps, the rise of ISIS, and even Bernie Madoff's $65 billion Ponzi scheme. All had warnings which went unheeded. When disaster struck, many people lost all they had or even died. Have there been any Cassandra-type warnings in the Bible? Yes. The Bible is full of them, including many which apply to our day and time. Jesus Christ spoke about how warnings from God typically go unheeded. And those delivering the warnings are often ridiculed or even killed. Over in Luke 11 in verse 47, in Luke 11, 47, it says, "Woe to you, for you build the tombs of the prophets and your fathers killed them." And over in Acts 7 in verse 52, Acts 7 in verse 52, it says, "Which of the prophets did your fathers not persecute? And they killed those who foretold the coming of the Just One, of whom you now have become the betrayers and murderers." Elijah was very aware of what happens to God's prophets. Over in 1 Kings 19 and verse 10. 1 Kings 19 and verse 10. So he said, "I've been very jealous for the Lord God host, for the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they seek to take my life." Yes, he was aware of what they did to prophets. Over in Nehemiah chapter 9, we'll read verses 24 through 26. Nehemiah 9, verses 24 through 26. "So the people went in and possessed the land and subdued before them the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, and gave them into their hands with their kings and the people of the land that they might do with them as they wished. And they took strong cities and a rich land and possessed houses full of all goods, cisterns already dug, vineyards, olive groves, and fruit trees in abundance. So they ate, were filled, and grew fat, and delighted themselves in your great goodness. Nevertheless, they were disobedient and rebelled against you, cast your law behind their backs," and look what they did to the prophets, "and killed your prophets who testified against them to turn them to yourself. And they worked great provocations." Going to the New Testament, 1 Thessalonians 2, verses 14 and 15. 1 Thessalonians 2, verses 14 and 15. "For you, brethren, became imitators of the churches of God which are in Judea in Christ Jesus. For you also suffered the same things from your own countrymen, just as they did from the Judeans." Notice this. "Who killed both the Lord Jesus and their own prophets, and have persecuted us. And they do not please God and are contrary to all men." Recall how Jesus lamented over Jerusalem in Matthew 23, verses 37. Matthew 23, verses 37. "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. Yes, even Jesus gave a Cassandra-type warning, which went unheeded. In fact, the Cassandra curse, listen carefully, the Cassandra curse is a thread that runs from one end of the Bible to the other. Even at the very end, when the two witnesses preach, they will be rejected and killed. One of the most amazing examples of the Cassandra curse found in the Bible is the preaching of Noah. Let's read about that over in Genesis 6, verses 17 and 18. Genesis 6, verses 17 and 18. And behold, I myself am bringing floodwaters on the earth to destroy from under the heaven all flesh in which is the breath of life. Everything that is on the earth shall die. But I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall go into the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you. And continuing about Noah in Hebrews 11, verse 7. Hebrews 11 and verse 7. It says, by faith, Noah, being divinely warned of things not yet seen, moved with godly fear, prepared an ark for the saving of his household, by which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. You see, Noah gave a Cassandra warning as a preacher of righteousness. We see that he is that in 2 Peter 2 and verse 5. 2 Peter 2 and verse 5. It says, and did not spare the ancient world, but saved Noah, one of eight people, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood on the world of the ungodly. Yes, Noah gave a Cassandra-type warning. People didn't listen. For 120 years, Noah was a witness to the coming flood. You know, he must have suffered great ridicule as he built a giant ark on dry land, probably a great distance from any large body of water. People must have scoffed at his labor until the ark was shut and water started coming in torrents. A characteristic of these last days, just like in Noah's time, is that the Cassandra warning will not be believed. Over in Luke 17, verses 26 and 27, it gives us this information. Luke 17, verses 26 and 27. As it was in the days of Noah, so it will be also in the days of the Son of Man. Listen carefully. If you notice this, normalcy bias. They ate, they drank, they married wives, they were given in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all. The normalcy bias blinded them in Noah's day to what was to come. Just as the people didn't believe God's messenger in the time of Noah, they will also not believe end time warnings. Now let's read the very next three verses for another example of a Cassandra type of warning. That's Luke 17, verses 28 through 30. Luke 17, verses 28 through 30. Continuing on, it says, likewise, as it was also in the days of Lot, they ate, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they built, But on the day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Even so will it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. Before Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed, a Cassandra-type message was given. Notice that in Genesis 19, verses 12 through 14. Genesis 19, verses 12 through 14. Before it was destroyed, a Cassandra-type message was given. Then the men said to Lot, "Have you anyone else here? Son-in-law, your sons, your daughters, whomever you have in the city? Take them out of this place, for we will destroy this place, because the outcry against them has grown great before the face of the Lord, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it." So Lot went out and spoke with his sons-in-law, who had married his daughters. And here's the Cassandra warning. He said, "Get up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy this city." But to his sons-in-law, he seemed to be joking. Cost him their lives. Over in Luke 17 and verse 30, it says, "Even so it will be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed." Will people just think we're joking? Sadly, the typical response to a Cassandra warning is to ignore it, or even to ridicule it, just like they did in Japan. Jeremiah 25 and verse 4. Jeremiah 25 and verse 4. "And the Lord has sent to you all his servants, the prophets, rising early and sending them, but you have not listened, nor inclined your ear to hear." 2 Peter 3, verses 2 through 4. 2 Peter 3, verses 2 through 4. "That you may be mindful of the words which were spoken before by the holy prophets, and of the commandment of us, the apostles of the Lord and Savior, knowing this first, that scoffers will come in the last days, walking according to their own lusts and saying," normalcy bias, right? "Where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation." You see, that's a perfect description of the normalcy bias. God's message to Israel regarding having a king turned out to be a Cassandra warning. Israel would not accept the warning. We see that over in 1 Samuel 8, verses 1 through 20. We'll read the whole story there. 1 Samuel 8, verses 1 through 20. Beginning in verse 1. "Now it came to pass when Samuel was old, and that he made his sons judges over Israel, the name of his firstborn was Joel, the name of the second Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba. But his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain. They took bribes, perverted judgment." Almost sounds like our government today, a lot of bribing going on. "Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, 'Look, you are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations.' But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. So Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, take heed here. Heed the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. According to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. Now, therefore, heed their voice. However, here comes the warning. You shall solemnly forewarn them and show them the behavior of the king who will reign over them. So Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who asked him for a king, and he said, this will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you. Here's the Cassandra warning. He will take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots and to be his horsemen, and some will run before his chariots. He will appoint captains over his thousands and captains over his fifties, will set some to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and some to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers. And he will take the best of your fields, your vineyards, and your olive groves, and give them to his servants. He will take a tenth of your grain and your vintage and give it to his officers and servants. He will take your male servants, your female servants, your finest young men, your donkeys, and put them to his work. He will take a tenth of your sheep, and you will be his servants. And you will cry out in that day because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourself. And the Lord will not hear you in that day. Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel. They would not heed the Cassandra-type warning. And they said, no, but we will have a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. You know how ironic that Israel wanted a human king to rule over them, yet when the Messiah came to his people, they rejected him as their king and said that the pagan Caesar in Rome was their king. That's over in John 19 and verse 15. John 19 and verse 15. But they cried out, away with him, away with him, crucify him. Pilate said to them, shall I crucify your king? The chief priests answered, we have no king but Caesar. We see how God's messengers were ignored, persecuted, or even killed in the Old Testament. But what about the New Testament? Of course, the number one example is Jesus Christ himself. Moses prophesied of one to come who would be a prophet like himself. And everyone who doesn't heed the message of that prophet would be utterly destroyed. Obviously, the prophet he spoke about was Jesus Christ. We see that over in Acts 3, verses 22 and 23. Acts 3, verses 22 and 23. Here it says, for Moses truly said to the fathers, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your brethren. Him you shall hear in all things, whatever he says to you, and it shall be that every soul who will not hear that prophet shall be utterly destroyed from among the people. Yes, Jesus was a prophet, and he came to his own, and his own received him not. In fact, they murdered him. John 1, verse 11, it says, he came to his own, and his own did not receive him. And over in Acts 5, in verse 30, Acts 5, in verse 30, it says, the God of our fathers raised up Jesus, whom you murdered by hanging on a tree. But what about today? Are there prophets today that we should be listening to and heeding? Certainly, God continues to guide and inspire his church. Jesus Christ has not left us as orphans. Over there in John 14, we read this Passover, John 14, verses 15 through 18. John 14, verses 15 through 18, it says, if you love me, keep my commandments, and I will pray the Father, and he will give you another helper, that he may abide with you forever, the Spirit of truth, whom the world cannot receive, because it neither sees him nor knows him. But you know him, for he dwells with you and will be in you. I will not leave you orphans. I will come to you. In the book of Acts, we see an entire chapter dedicated to one Cassandra event. Now, this chapter is rarely preached in its entirety, but it contains some vital information for us today to understand the Cassandra curse. So we're going to go through it today. Paul gave a Cassandra-type warning in Acts chapter 27, and it was ignored. We will begin reading in Acts 27, verse 1, and we'll go through the whole chapter, because there's so much there, and it's rarely preached. Here God inspired an entire chapter in the Bible to this one Cassandra warning and the events that followed. If you notice, it's written in the first person because Luke was on board with Paul at the time, recording all of this. Notice that those in charge didn't listen to Paul's warning. We'll notice this as we read it. Only after they were in dire straits and had suffered loss did they begin to listen to his instructions. Also notice that God gave Paul the inspiration and instructions to deal with the catastrophe to make sure Paul made it safely to Rome. So beginning in verse 1 of Acts 27, and when it was decided that we should sail to Italy, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to one named Julius, a centurion of the Augustan regiment. Now, there are probably quite a few soldiers on there. A centurion, typically, you know, we think of as being 100 soldiers under, but that was usually too many, and they usually cut it back down to 80. But there was quite a few soldiers on board. So, entering a ship of Adramyttium, we put to sea, meaning to sail along the coast of Asia. Aristarchus, a Macedonian Thessalonica, was with us. And the next day we landed at Sidon. And Julius, that's the centurion, treated Paul kindly and gave him liberty to go to his friends and receive care. When we had put to sea from there, we sailed under the shelter of Cyprus because the winds were contrary. And when we had sailed over the sea, which is off Sicily, Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra, a city of Lycia. There the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing to Italy, and he put us on board. Now, there are probably quite a few prisoners. Some of them were actually being taken to Rome, probably to fight in the arena to their death. When we had sailed slowly many days and arrived with difficulty at Cnidus, the wind not permitting us to proceed, we sailed under the shelter of Crete off Salmone. Passing it with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Havens near the city of Lasea. Now, when much time had been spent and sailing was now dangerous because the fast was already over, here comes the warning. Paul advised them, saying, "Men, I perceive that this voyage will end with disaster and much loss, not only the cargo and ship, but also our lives. Nevertheless," the centurion was more persuaded by the helmsman and the owner of the ship than by the things spoken by Paul. The warning was ignored. And because the harbor was not suitable to winter in, the majority advised to set sail from there also, if by any means they could reach Phoenice, a harbor of Crete, opening toward the southwest and northwest, and winter there. When the south wind blew softly, supposing that they had obtained their desire, putting out to sea, they sailed close to Crete. But not long after, a tempestuous headwind arose. Now, in the Greek, that word tempestuous, the root of it, is where we get the word typhoon. So to give you an idea of what kind of storm this was. This was not a thunderstorm. This was like a hurricane or a typhoon called Euryclean. It's kind of like a northeaster. So when the ship was caught and could not head into the wind, we let her drive. And running under the shelter of an island called Claudia, we secured the skiff with difficulty. When they had taken it on board, they used cables to undergird the ship. And fearing lest they should run aground on the citrus sands, quicksand, they struck sail and so were driven. And because we were exceedingly tempest-tossed, that's an understatement if you're in a typhoon, the next day they lightened the ship. On the third day, we threw the ship's tackle overboard with our own hands. Now when neither sun nor stars appeared for many days and no small tempest beat on us, all hope that we would be saved was finally given up. But after long abstinence from food, then Paul stood in the midst of them and said, what did he say? "Men, you should have listened to me and not have sailed from Crete and incurred this disaster and loss. And now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only the ship. For there stood by me this night an angel of God, of the God whom I belong and whom I serve, saying, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must be brought before Caesar. And indeed, God has granted you all those who sail with you. Therefore, take heart, men, for I believe God that it will be just as it was told me. However, we must run aground on a certain island.'" That's described in chapter 28. "Now, when the 14th night had come, as we were driven up and down in the Adriatic Sea, about midnight, the sailors sensed that they were drawing near some land. And they took soundings and found it to be 20 fathoms. And when they had gone a little further, they took soundings again and found that it to be 15 fathoms. Then, fearing lest we should run aground on the rocks, they dropped four anchors from the stern and prayed for day to come. And as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship, when they had let down the skiff into the sea under pretense of putting out anchors from the prow, Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, 'Unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved.'" Then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the skiff and let it fall off. So they're all still on board. And as day was about to dawn, Paul implored them all to take some food, saying, "Today is the 14th day. You have waited and continue without food." That's a major, major fast. "And eaten nothing. Therefore, I urge you to take nourishment, for this is for your survival, since not a hair will fall from the head of any of you." And when he had said these things, he took bread and gave thanks to God in the presence of them all. And when he had broken it, he began to eat. Then they were all encouraged and also took food themselves. And in all, we were 276 persons on the ship. So when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship and threw out the wheat into the sea. When it was day, they did not recognize the land, but they observed a bay with a beach onto which they planned to run the ship if possible. And they let go the anchors and left them in the sea. Meanwhile, loosening the rudder ropes, they hoisted the mainsail to the wind and made for shore. But striking a place where two seas met, they ran the ship aground, hit a reef. And the prow stuck fast and remained immovable. But the stern was being broken up by the violence of the waves. And the soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners, lest any of them should swim away and escape. And the reason why is that if the prisoners escaped, then the guards get killed. That's the Roman rule. But the centurion wanted to save Paul, kept them from their purpose, and commanded that that those who could swim should jump off overboard first and get to land, and the rest, some on boards, some on parts of the ship. And so it was that they all escaped safely to the land. Now, I spent a bit of time, that's 6 minutes approximately, reading that chapter. But there's a reason, because we're going to go through it now and do some analyzing. Notice that Paul did not say that his warning was a prophecy from God. He said, "Men, I perceive that this voyage will end with disaster and much loss, not only of the cargo and ship, but also our lives." Later he said, "Men, you should have listened to me." He did not say you should have listened to God's prophecy. It was something he perceived as a wise man and an experienced sea traveler on the Mediterranean. See, it's estimated that Paul had already traveled some 3,500 miles by sea by this time in his ministry. Knowing the season and the conditions on the Mediterranean after the Day of Atonement, Paul advised that they not go on. From the account in 2 Corinthians 11:25, we know that by this time Paul had already experienced shipwreck 3 times, and had even spent a night and a day in the deep. So he knows a little bit about sea travel and what it's like to be shipwrecked. So important lessons are to be found in this account in Acts 27. Let's review them. First, Cassandra-type warnings often come from wise and knowledgeable individuals. Cassandra-type warnings often come from wise and knowledgeable individuals. They do not have to come as divine prophecies. Remember Dr. Okamura's earthquake warnings was not a divine warning, but a warning from a wise and knowledgeable expert. Second, wisdom is often trumped by positional authority. Wisdom is often trumped by positional authority. Now, a poor wise man is rarely listened to. It is usually assumed that those in positions of authority are the wisest, which may not be true. Notice in verse 11 of chapter 27 that the centurion was more persuaded by the helmsman and the owner of the ship than by the things spoken by Paul. Third, when a Cassandra-type warning is given, the majority opinion is often wrong. When a Cassandra-type warning is given, the majority opinion is often wrong. Notice in verse 12 of chapter 27 that the majority advised to set sail. Bad mistake. Fourth, Cassandra-type warnings are often ignored because of some pressing desire. Cassandra-type warnings are often ignored because of some pressing desire. In this case, Fair Havens, mentioned in verse 8, was where Paul advised them to winter. However, Fair Havens was not all that fair. It was probably named by their Chamber of Commerce. The position of the bay made it vulnerable to winter winds and storms. It was not an ideal place for the centurion to winter his men for months. The ship's owner wanted to get his grain to a larger port so he could sell it. It didn't seem crazy to them to make it to the more populated city of Phoenice and be spared a miserable winter at Fair Havens. In other words, as one commentary stated, greed and the desire for comfort got in the way of good sense. Fifth, Cassandra-type warnings are often ignored due to the warning coming from someone of a lower social estate or one who is not wealthy. In Acts 27, we see that Paul was a prisoner, a social position of low estate. The centurion listened to the ship's owner, obviously one of greater social status and wealth than Paul. You know, people tend to equate wealth with wisdom, such is often not the case. Recall this warning from Jesus over in Luke 12, verses 16 through 21. Luke 12, verses 16 through 21. Then he spoke a parable to them, saying, "The ground of a certain rich man yielded plentifully. And he thought within himself, saying, 'What shall I do, since I have no room to store my crops?' So he said, 'I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build greater. And there I will store all my crops and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry.'" I think I heard that in Noah's day. "But God said to him, 'Fool, this night your soul shall be required of you. Then whose will those things be which you have provided? So is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. Often the rich are so focused on their wealth and on obtaining more that they are oblivious to impending dangerous circumstances. It is often the individual of lesser means that is aware of such circumstances and issues a Cassandra-type warning." Sadly, the rich often ignore the Cassandra warning from such an individual, thinking that because of their wealth, they are smarter and wiser. Another important point is that a Cassandra warning is not always about some great catastrophe. A Cassandra warning isn't always about some massive event such as the Fukushima disaster, the rise of the terrorist group ISIS, or the destruction caused by Hurricane Katrina. In Acts 27, the disaster was limited to the loss of a single ship and its cargo. Thankfully, due to God's divine intervention, not a single life was lost. A Cassandra-type warning might be directed to an entire nation, a community, an organization, a church, Revelation 2 and 3, or even a family, or even to an individual. Over the years, I have seen numerous Cassandra warnings given to organizations, families, and even individuals, yet they went unheeded. And the result? Great sadness or serious loss of one kind or another. You know, a loss can come in many forms. Some losses are financial. Some result in legal battles. Some result in the destruction of a family unit or a child going astray and ending up in very bad circumstances. I've seen parents in the church turn a deaf ear to Cassandra warnings from a friend, relative, or elder as to how they were raising their child with sorrowful results. As Christians, how can we be sure that a warning is true and not false? Is there any instruction in God's word to help us? Fortunately, there is. Here are some important points to consider when receiving a warning. First, is the person or persons giving the warning regarded as having knowledge, experience, and/or expertise touching the warning? For instance, a Cassandra warning was given to NASA by engineers. The engineers who had studied the O-rings of previous launches knew that the O-rings on the booster rockets of the Space Shuttle Challenger would fail if launched in the cold weather. They warned that such a launch would result in catastrophic failure. Since NASA was behind schedule, they ignored the warning of the engineers and made a management decision to ignore the data. They decided to launch the Challenger anyway, resulting in the death of all 7 crew members. Second, is the person or persons giving the warning regarded as having wisdom? Now, wisdom is the quality of having the combination of experience, knowledge, and good judgment. Good judgment. You know, the Bible is full of verses about the wise and how we should seek out wise counsel. Recall how Paul corrected the Corinthians for brethren going to law against one another rather than seeking a wise brother to judge the matter. Over in 1 Corinthians 6, verses 5 and 6, we read that. 1 Corinthians 6, verses 5 and 6. I say this to your shame. Is it so that there is not a wise man among you? Not even one who will be able to judge between his brethren, but brother goes to law against brother, and that before the unbelievers. Over in Proverbs 12 and verse 15. In Proverbs 12 and verse 15, it says, "The way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but he who heeds counsel is wise." And in the chapter before that, in Proverbs 11, verse 14, Proverbs 11 and verse 14, "Where there is no counsel, the people fall, but in the multitude of counselors, there is safety. Those who ignore counsel run the risk of not listening to true warnings." Recall, there were multiple warnings about the tsunami in Japan, not just one. "We should all seek out people who are wise and use their input before rejecting a warning." Isn't it interesting that Isaiah prophesied that Jesus would be called Counselor in Isaiah 9 and verse 6? Third, does the person giving the warning have a history of being wrong regarding past warnings? You know, some people, for instance, are known as prophets of doom. Some see trouble around every corner. And after a while, people just stop paying attention. Recall the story of Chicken Little, who warned that the sky was falling. A Chicken Little person seems to always have a mistaken belief that disaster is imminent. There seems to always be people around like that. Since the version of the Chicken Little story goes back 25 centuries. Fourth, when a warning is given, are you ignoring the warning because of a personal desire you have for a different outcome, not based on reality or supported by data or evidence? Sometimes facing a Cassandra warning is so painful that we close our ears to it and continue in wishful thinking. Fifth, when given a warning, do you reject it in haste before taking the time to consider the warning properly? Over in Proverbs 18 and verse 13. Proverbs 18 and verse 13. "He who answers a matter before he hears it, it is folly and shame to him." Can't tell you how many people I've encountered over the years that I've tried to warn about something. Instant rejection. Instant rejection. James 1 and verse 19. James 1 and verse 19. "So then, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, and slow to wrath." Why do people reject a warning in haste? Usually it's because they don't want to believe the warning can happen. It is a manifestation of what we have examined earlier, the normalcy bias. One of the most important elements in combating the normalcy bias is understanding its effects on your psyche and the fact that you are likely already affected by it. If you are saying to yourself that everything is fine or that the warnings could never happen, you probably already have the normalcy bias. The normalcy bias is that little voice in your head that tells you everything will turn out just like it always has. A-OK. But brethren, we are living in troubling times. We will hear many Cassandra warnings coming our way, both from the pulpit and from other sources. Some will be physical warnings, such as getting out of debt and preparing to lower our standard of living as the world continues to be awash in astronomical debt. Some warnings will be spiritual warnings to not be deceived and to prepare for the return of the bridegroom. Recall that there were five wise and five foolish virgins in the parable in Matthew 5. Will you be one of the five wise virgins or one of the foolish? You know, when the bridegroom returns, what manner of person will you be in holy conduct and godliness? You know, great deception is coming. In Matthew 24:24, we see that warning. Matthew 24:24. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if it were possible, even the elect. So, brethren, my hope is that this sermon has accomplished the following. First, it's made you aware of the Cassandra warning and curse. They are true warnings which are not regarded by others. Second, the sermon has given important information for recognizing the normalcy bias both in yourself and others. Third, it has shown you that the Cassandra curse is all through the Bible, both the Old and the New Testament. Time and again, men have rejected God's messengers and the warnings sent from God. Zechariah 7 and verse 11. Zechariah 7 and verse 11. But they refused to heed, shrugged their shoulders, and stopped their ears so they could not hear. You know, this could be a cautioning call to all of us. Fourth, the sermon has shown a specific Cassandra warning and curse through the example of Paul's voyage to Rome described in Acts 27. Fifth, it has given some important points to consider regarding how to distinguish a true warning from a false one. And I encourage you to think more about this because this is not a complete list. And finally, we live in a time where catastrophic threats are growing exponentially, yet the din of denial is deafening. So it's my hope that this sermon has drawn attention to the danger of not heeding both physical and spiritual warnings being given to us in this end time.